trust. Not to mention that Niles stood a chance at trial this way. They were trapped.
"And I've thought about this, naturally," says Edgar. "I've thought at great length about what Hardcore did, and I doubt his motive was to punish Niall. I doubt that entered his mind, or only to minimize his position in a very bad situation. What he wanted also was to make a point to me. To let me know I was not the only shrewd operator. That for all my grand proclamations, all my ill-considered threats, I still couldn't protect Niall."
Edgar glances briefly, balefully, toward Seth, before staring down again into his teacup, which bears the blue seal of some state agency.
Somehow, I had made myself the one true enemy. Which is why I told Hobie from the start, blame me. I actually said that to him. Blame me. And not as an act of misplaced valor. You know, I see that look in your eye. I saw it in court. I think you've regarded me for decades as a monster. People way back when, back in California, people believed I was not self-aware. Perhaps I wasn't, not sufficiently. But I think, I believe, I see some of myself. And I mean that when I say I am to blame. I am. For thinking I could control what I couldn't control. For bearding Hardcore. For not accepting my child's limitations. For pushing my own wants on him. I saw that. I'd seen that. People, some people, do see these things. Insight isn't everything, you know. You make mistakes anyway. And I made those mistakes, and a dozen more. I was pleased that Sonny was the judge. I suppose that was where it really started. Well, this will fit, I thought. I saw the opportunity immediately. I told Tuttle that the first time we spoke. She never liked me, blame me, contrive some other reason Cor on his own would want to kill me. She'll believe it. I started this, I know. And Hobie twisted it, of course. He took advantage of me. He said, "Will you say yes if I ask the questions the right way?" I told him, "I won't lie. I just can't. I can't swear an oath to God and lie. But the right question? The right way? I could say yes." And he told me before it started. He said very little to me. Just listen to my questions very carefully, because I'm going to be doing something. You don't have to lie. Just be careful. And I agreed to that in advance. I knew he'd use that money, the $10,000 from the DFU, and make it look like that was the money Niall had given Ordell. Because, after all, that was the plan. And yes, Niall had cashed the check. And no one had any reason to know where the money actually had gone. And, of course, Hardcore was lying. There never was a $10,000 payment. So what Hobie was doing, it was a lie to combat a lie, and not my lie. And naturally, I agreed. He's very shrewd about people, your friend Tuttle, isn't he?
Very shrewd.
Yes, says Edgar.
His feet, in his old penny loafers, are tapping on the floor now, but thought has otherwise stilled him. He is somewhat nattily dressed, in a stylish plaid shirt, and he pulls momentarily at the collar. He thought he was being noble, he says, not merely toward Niall, but toward the party people, Galliacos and his crowd. They were after him from the minute Niall was arrested, and Edgar had promised he'd do everything in his power to keep that $10,000 out of the case, out of the news. They were terrified, understandably. Imagine what it's like, Edgar says, trying to convince people to make contributions when they've read on the front page of the Tribune about party money going to a street gang. He was willing to take the blame for all of it, for the money, for Niall.
"Blame me," I said. And Hobie pulled the rug out, turned the tables, made day, night, night, day. Now I who loved June Edgar better and longer than any soul on earth. Now I was her murderer. And this is where you come into it, Seth, or where I've always imagined you came into it. Because I could see you having the last laugh, both of you. As I was sitting there, I understood. I could see the parallels. I had agreed to something, to be used in something, a deception for the benefit of someone I cared about, as you agreed many years ago, Seth, and then were changed up, misled. Tit for tat. I understood. This strange, theatrical revenge. You said it before. You regard me as a man who got away with murder. So why not let me take the blame in public for one I did not commit? I was quite sure you two believed it was entirely appropriate. It's entirely appropriate, Seth answers. But he never told me.
No?
Edgar again considers Seth askance.
Well, it was a gleeful experience for him, I'll say that. Because he had me.
I could see in the courtroom. Hobie was laughing at me in a thousand different ways. Most of all, because he was saying,
What for your child? This much? More? How about this much? How much, you bastard? How much?
And he relished it. It was sadistic. No, says Seth. He's not a sadist.
It surely appeared that way.
No, says Seth again. He ponders the curve of events. The vast, imponderable enigma of Hobie T. Tuttle looms here, like the Buddha emerging from the mists. Impetuous, yes. Complex. Brilliant. But Hobie would never have permitted such a twisted sport for his own sake. He'd have laughed to think of it. The notion would have kept him up all night chuckling. But he carried through only for one reason. He did it for me, Edgar. Seth says, not with me. He did it because he's my friend, and was Cleveland's friend. In his heart of hearts, he was taking our revenge, as well as helping Niall, of course. I'm sure he meant to do that, too. Edgar holds the thought, then lets his head bow with the weight of that possibility. Out on the gravel drive, Seth hears the crunching of someone's approach. It's Niall, Seth thinks. It's Michael. That would be perfect. They'll shuffle in, unshaven, weary from the road. But when Edgar returns from the front door, he's merely holding an overnight delivery envelope, papers parceled off from the state capitol for the senator's inspection.
Have you talked to Niall?
Seth asks. Edgar, sadly, futilely, flexes his hands.
No way to reach him. I know they're together, Michael and he. You realized that much, I take it.
Says Edgar, and again casts a glance at the paper Hobie gave Seth last night.
I heard from Michael once. In the immediate aftermath, a day or two later. Sounded like he was at a payphone by a highway. I was quite relieved. I have every confidence that Michael won't let Niall come to grief. They're very capable together. What's the word? Syntonic. I suppose they always have been. They'll look after one another. And I'm certain that, in a desperate case, Michael could get word to me. You should understand, says Edgar. I could find them. They have to be within a day's drive. Michael wouldn't have much appetite for change. He's not good with it. He's still probably going by the same name, the same social security number we dug up for him when he gave his to you. I have no doubt they're settled in another little town.
Sipping the tea, Seth takes an instant to imagine Niall and Michael together, as Edgar described them. Probably living on some rented farmette with a tiny frame house which the wind blows through in the winter. Working day jobs in town, clerks or something, tilling the earth as weekends and summer light allow. They probably speak little. Michael these days surfs the internet instead of the shortwave bands. Niall watches TV. But they make allowances for each other, and to the world they are father and son. One of those odd pairs families often create, attuned to each other and hardly anybody else. Niall has become the man he always wanted to be. Michael, another erratic fugitive. The best example he had.
I could find them, Edgar repeats. But I'm not going to trail Niall as if I were a bounty hunter. When he wants to see me, he will. I understand how it is. He's likely to keep running, isn't he? If I pursue him.
I think that's right.
I think it's a shame, says Edgar. His reason for fleeing? That's more or less how I explain it to myself.
Sounds more like anger to me.
Anger?
Asks Edgar. He shows the first open surprise since the moment he saw Seth on his porch this morning. I bet the sight of you on the witness stand lying your ass off to save him, playing along with Hobie, whatever you want to call it, was probably more than he could stomach. I take it neither of you bothered to fill in Niall in advance. They're both too high-handed to have troubled with that, Seth knows. Edgar was right before, he thinks, insight isn't everything, because it's seldom complete. Edgar might see himself as meddlesome, overly protective, but he'll never recognize the message he delivered to Niall on every possible occasion, that his son would always be beholden, incapable, incomplete.
But isn't it puzzling? Edgar asks. I think about it every day, for hours. And I'm baffled. Perhaps he was angry, as you say, at the end of the trial. I surely meant well. But we could have misunderstood one another. That's an old story. But what could he have been thinking to start? Getting mixed up that way? With Cor? In that kind of business? What did he want?
Seth takes his time, although he's known the answer from the moment Edgar told him the story. I imagine he wanted to be one of the people you cared about, Edgar. This observation, leveled with no more mercy than a hammer blow, provokes little visible reaction at first. Edgar brings his hand to his mouth momentarily. On the wall, there's a large white clock. It buzzes faintly, clicking slightly whenever the second hand moves. 8:10. He may miss his plane, Seth thinks, but he has no desire to go.
It's so complex, Edgar says finally.
He circles a finger through a little puddle of gathered moisture left on the table by the bottom of his cup.
I am not one to dwell on the past, Seth, but whenever I think back, what seems the bleakest and most confused to me is Niall. I loved him so truly, so deeply. I still think of his birth as a moment like no other. I can describe the hospital waiting room. It was the days when men were not involved.
He permits himself the wee, reflective smile, Seth recollects, as neither of them should make much of the oddity that Edgar, the great suspect of institutional power, lost his radar at a moment so essential.
I recall the other fathers sitting around. A sandwich one of these men was eating. It was peanut butter and bacon, which he'd brought from home in used-looking silver foil. I can remember everything. I can smell the smoke from everybody's cigarettes. It seemed such a perfect recompense that a son should have been born to me, who so suffered his own father, who was still wrestling him the way Jacob in that wonderful passage in the scripture wrestled the angel of death all night. I thought...
He gropes, staring to the distance and the past.
It seemed very important,
Edgar says. It was, says Seth.
Yes, it was. It was, of course it was. I mean, merely that the path seemed clear. The way seemed certain. Everything I should do and shouldn't do. And, of course, it wasn't. I was terribly afraid of him. Terribly scared of him, almost at once. Terrified of this little tiny child. Of course, I couldn't say to myself that it was fear I felt. I just seemed frozen up somehow. I seemed commanded by some kind of learned response instead of my own inmost impulses. Oh, God. And there is another of those improbable moments Seth first witnessed in the courtroom. Loyal Edgar is crying. He is probably entitled to comfort, Seth realizes. As a father, Seth has comfort to give, but not to this man. He sits on the other side of the table in silence as Edgar sobs a second, then recovers.
And I would watch him with you and Michael. You recall how he was with Michael, Seth? I would just watch the two of them out there in that tree, pounding, sawing, laughing at one another. I'd feel terrible, just terrible, because I still loved him so, so much. I was brimming with feeling. Looking back, I think I felt more honest emotion toward Niall than any other person in my life. And I would worry and worry and worry about one thing, one question all the time. It sounds like madness now, but I was haunted by this question, maddened by it, absolutely obsessed. If I had to give him up, I kept thinking, if I had to give him up, could I?
Give him up? Asks Seth.
Yes, to the revolution, if the day came. If I had to let him fight, do things that would endanger him. It never seemed, you can take this as you like, I'm sure you're doubtful, question motives. I'd do the same, probably. But it never seemed awful to be placing ourselves in danger. June, me, I could imagine, I had imagined that. You know all the prison literature that's been created by captured leaders? I'd read that. Torture, isolation? I'd imagine that.
And gloried, probably, in the prospect, Seth thinks. Edgar's grayish hair has fallen forward, over his brow, as he looks down to his folded hands.
But I was riven, he says, agonized by the total quandary of being a parent. How could I show Niall everything I treasured and believed, which I seemed impelled to do? How could I do that? And then confront the moment decades on when that led to his sacrifice. Would I be able to pay that price, I kept asking? Would I be able to let him go? My son, my love, my life, my future. I avoided thinking about it for months, and then the question would strike me more powerfully than any fear I've ever felt for myself, and I found no comfort, really. But was led back again and again by some distraught impulse to the words of the scripture, that God's greatest love was shown by this, that he gave us the life of his only son. As if that thought could really be any help, as if it could do anything but deepen the mystery.
He stands, draining the last from his cup. He claps his shirt pockets, and, not finding what he's seeking, removes his glasses and wipes his eyes on his sleeve. On the worn heels of his loafers, he crosses into the brilliant path of light that emerges from the window, an elongated parallelogram divided by the shadowed mullions, and nods from the doorway, older and littler than he was in Seth's memory. With one hand, he attempts some heartless gesture, a farewell, and a direction to Seth to show himself out. He goes. It will take pure luck now to make his plane to Seattle. Traveling far too fast, he dodges traffic on 8:43 in the morning rush. So, are you done now? He finally asks himself. In part, he still valiantly resists everything pulling on him in the wake of this visit. It wasn't genuine, Seth keeps thinking. The tears, the torment. Like all great actors, Edgar will always become exactly who his audience wishes him to be. But there is no turning away from his vulnerability to Edgar. That was fixed long ago, in the stars, in the genes, in nature.
So what's the point? Seth asks himself. Everybody has his story, his grief. He knew that. Already, he knew it. Maybe it's what he said to Hobie last night, about love and justice. Maybe there is no difference, in the ideal, at least. Maybe love and justice are one. He drives on. Are you done now?
April 4th, 1996. Seth, who writes letters anymore? This is probably an act of craziness. But Dubinsky dropped off the copies of the eulogies the Trib people had printed. Beautiful, aren't they? This was a touching gesture, Seth. I'm a little too hard-headed to hold on to them on the assumption you're coming back. And I can't simply slide them into this envelope without a word of my own. It's 9:30 now. Hot time, as you say. The hour we have spent together most nights. I miss you. The laughter, the connection. I have nasty thoughts. The body yearns. Which means what? I've been running all the what-ifs in my mind, watching each clip to see the different endings to our movie. Nothing is exactly right. But I thought I'd take you at your word and speak my mind. At least the part I know. We're both relatively honest. I regard that as one of our pluses. When I left Charlie at the age of 44, I had to recognize that I'm one of those people who may never come to rest, never find the opening in the world where I am going to squarely fit. My life, in its current shape, will tumble on for a while, and then I'll feel the way I always do, that it's not quite right, that maybe there's something better or not quite as bad over the next hill, and I'll be gone in that direction. There are times I think almost abstractly about my lifetime of shifting obsessions and feel washed away by a pounding wave of shame. 4 different graduate programs, all my jobs, and men, and 1,000 pastimes undertaken with unflagging ardor, each intended to save my spirit at night while my body slaved in obeisance to the future during the day. The relics are in that horrible Fibber's closet of a basement where I won't let you roam. An enormous loom, plastic jugs and curing vats, I was going to culture my own wine, bridles, bits, and saddle from the period I decided to retake my squandered childhood by riding. Not to mention the boxes of Why Me literature and the books on various dietary obsessions. Each of these phases passed away, lifted like fog, traceless if you do not count the accessories that mildew in the cellar, or a single blanket I wove which Nikki still clutches for comfort when she sleeps. At my worst moments, I suspect I bore Nikki simply to have an anchor. And even having done that, I'm never right, never fully at ease. I know there's a chance I'll be here by myself at the end, on the other side of something I'm still longing to get over. There's a lot of pain in that. Not just the recognition, but the fact. Yet there are moments, like now, when I'm more or less at peace and willing to say, maybe that's me. If this thing, us, if it doesn't work out, I'm going to be okay. I know that. It's one of the best lessons I learned from Zora. I know how to wrap my arms around myself, and I don't mean that as a sop. It may even be a warning. Which is not to deny I'm angry. I am. I'm aggravated that you're gone and that you let it come to this with 2 women reaching after you. I ask myself questions I heard in my head all the time with Charlie. Why does it seem to be women who have to stand up for everything of real value in the world? For children, first of all, for nurturance, for homes, and yes, even love. I know that's not entirely fair. I sometimes watch you with Nikki in mild amazement, unloading her backpack, making snacks. I leave you a lot more room to be that person than Lucy ever did. But it's your confidence and contentment that are striking. The way you see a household. Not a war zone. Not a field of mutual striving. Not some prolonged adolescence in which the partners travel, each for themselves. But a family. You can show me how to do that, as Charlie, of course, never did. And even so, that's hard for me because it leaves me wrestling with the hardest question of all. Whether it's me you need, or Nikki. In the end, we both have to deal with the fact that it's loss that brings you to me. History, circumstances, and events. They still stand between us. I never would have suspected the degree to which I'm haunted by our past together. 25 years, you think. We were only children. And yet it feels like it could be fatal. What's the difference now, I wonder? Why won't we fail the same way we did a quarter century ago? I suspect these are the furthest questions from your mind, Seth. What's the saying? Within the body of every cynic beats the broken heart of a romantic. You still believe in the transforming power of will and love. It's so endearing. I want to let you win, to triumph at this quest. I know how important it is for you. But I worry I may let you down the way I did decades ago. Back then, you needed my devotion, probably so you had the strength to stand apart from your parents. And I couldn't provide it. Not as I think you feared then, because I didn't believe in or admire you. You do not know 10 people, Seth, who feel more vindicated or less surprised by the way the world has embraced your talent. No. What troubled me was your celestial devotion to me. To the girl philosophy student who was supposed to light up the skies at Miller Damon. Because I knew she was a fake. Oh, I had certain gifts. I've never sold myself short. I read Plato while I was still in high school, and believed what Socrates said about knowledge as life's highest quest. To the thought of replacing passion with reason, some singing, passionate chord in me responded. Instead, over time, I learned that the differing endpoints of various philosophical excursions were due largely to the places they'd begun. The zero points. The irreducible assumptions, it's who you are to start that makes the difference. And in that light, Plato was, if not wrong, at least deserving of correction. All knowledge derives from passion. And what my passions were was largely a mystery, certainly not philosophy. I read the texts in a bloodless way like an inspector on a tour. I was, I suddenly decided, leading someone else's life. Whose? I didn't have a clue then. But my mother knew, like Holy Writ, those heavyweight German philosophers I studied. To this day, I can hear her shrilling at meetings, "That is not what Engels meant, never!" So I fled, mystified about my motives. All my life, I've been afraid I lack common sense. My mother, shrewd as she was, had none. I mean that she seemed to forget that people would be hurt if she called them names, that a small child might need a meal now and then, that she couldn't work in South Carolina and be a mother to me here. It wasn't just that she seemed at times to feel overpowered by her own needs. The truth is that we all do. But she had no recognition when it was occurring. And even now, I'm afraid she left the same traits in me, the way an unhappy spirit is supposed to remain in a woodland tree. "You're acting just like Zora," is something I can unleash against myself with the primitive anger of a curse, as I prime myself not to act or speak or feel in given ways. It turns out that one of the passageways to my adulthood was this vow, this secret I didn't even tell myself out loud, not to be like her. Don't misunderstand. I loved my mother. Yet it was years, not until the end of that trial was nearing, since I felt free to embrace the best of her. I believe Zora would be proud of me. And I know she would adore Nikki. Both thoughts mean a lot. But throughout my younger years, I wanted a lot more. I wanted her to be my salvation, my ideal. God, I needed that. I would feel 50 times a day how much I could utilize the strength born of knowing I could simply form myself to her example. And it's my task, the stone I've been rolling up the hill forever, to recognize that can't take place, to see, even though I couldn't bear to say it most of my life, that she was, at moments, a selfish lunatic, that there were times when all her passions, her anxieties, all her towering concerns made me beside the point. Here I am in the shadow of 50, and there still are mornings I wake to happy dreams of the total, devoted, desperate way I loved her when I was young. And when it comes to me, that's no longer right, possible, real. I'm crushed. My spirit's broken for hours. She loved me. Passionately. When it suited her. In response, I learned how to hold some distance. Big surprise. And resolved with the same desperation of my love for her that I would try not to be as unhappy as she was. Because I knew that for certain, too, that nutsy Zora with her rages, speeches, scraps of quotes, with her warm whispers for me, her smell of lotion, her walleye, her midnight pacing, meetings, and constant grumbling at the way of the world, that she was swirling like some nebula around a livid core of pain. The project of my life is to cherish what I can of her, and yet to be neither her mindless imitator nor her willing victim. I will always worship her ferocious independence, but I would rather be dungeon condemned for all eternity than consign myself to her isolation. I want you to understand how hard this is for me, to be the one writing this letter, to be the one speaking first, to be the one asking. It seems almost cruel to have to say yes, knowing you may say no. But I heard what you said the other night, and I know this won't happen any other way. You are entitled to be told that you are needed. More, essential. Not only to Nikki, but to me. You are. It has taken my whole life for me to say this, but I deserve someone I can rely on, through and through. I know you can be that person, Seth, if I let you. I want to try. This is a love letter. Sunny.
Eulogy for Bernhard Weissman by Seth Daniel Weissman, April 1st, 1996. I always return to the story of Abraham and Isaac when I think about my father. Some of that springs from the legacy which gave our son his name. But there is more to it, of course. No doubt we all recall the story. Abraham was the founder of the Western faiths, the first Jew, the first person to know the God to whom most peoples in the world now pray. He was a visionary, a prophet, and surely an iconoclast capable of cleaving to his beliefs in the face of universal scorn. But despite this, Abraham's God decided to test him. He asked Abraham to make a sacrifice of his and Sarah's only child, Isaac, their miracle, who had been born to them when Sarah was already 90 years old and Abraham 100. And according to the story, Abraham complied. He did not say what we hope a father of today might. I am hearing ugly voices. I need help. He did not ask what was wrong with a God who would demand such a thing, or question whether he was worth worshiping. He did not, so far as the Bible tells us, even beg for Isaac's life, as he had done for the people of Sodom. Abraham simply walked his child up Mount Moriah. I imagine he even made the boy carry the wood for the fire. When Isaac asked where the lamb might be for the religious sacrifice they were undertaking, Abraham told him God was bringing the lamb. In candor, I have regarded this for some years now as a strange story, a grim tale of how a father would sacrifice his son to his own faith, his own visions. What kind of starting point is this for us anyway, for all the Western faiths? Celebrating the twisted dynamic between the first Jewish father and the first Jewish son. Why do we retell this story? Is it to remind us that every parent since has done better? I initially asked these questions in an anguished state. It was the last time I ever entered a synagogue. The occasion was the New Year. The other congregants were there to express their commitments to what is referred to now and again in the writings as the God, the faith, and the laws of our fathers. I was there to say the mourner's prayer, inasmuch as not much time had passed since my own boy named Isaac had died. For us, Lucy and Sarah, and certainly for me, it's probably the case that every funeral we go to for the rest of our lives will be Isaac's. I apologize for having to share this, but in order to speak of my father, I also have to talk about my children. Our wonderful, extraordinary daughter, for whose presence I thank God and all else in the universe every day, and the son we lost. I don't know how many of you here know the story of how our Isaac came to be given that name, but it is, fittingly, my father's story, and the one we all shudder to recall. In March 1938, the German army marched into Austria and brought with them their war against the Jews. Jewish businesses were emblazoned with signs and vandalized or confiscated, while 12,000 Jewish families were thrown out of their homes. The Nazis turned synagogues into smoking parlors and beat at random Jews found on the streets. On April 23rd, a Saturday, in Vienna, that most genteel of cities, the home of Sigmund Freud and Gustav Mahler, a group of Jews was taken to the Prater, Vienna's amusement park, and there, in the presence of the usual weekend crowd, the SS forced the Jews to their knees and made them eat the lawn. By June, more than 500 Viennese Jews had committed suicide. On the 16th of that month, my father, his young wife, and their four-year-old son, who had been out together for a hasty visit to a shop, were accosted by stormtroops. They were informed that their home was now state property. In the next 3 years, they moved half a dozen times as more and more of the city was closed to Jewish residency. Jews were removed from their jobs and forced to wear the yellow star when they walked down the street. But my father remained. His mother-in-law had had a stroke and was not transportable, and emigration became increasingly difficult as time went on and the nations throughout Eastern Europe closed their borders for fear of being overrun by Austria's 180,000 Jews. More to the point, flight would have shattered some essential vision of himself. He was very much the man he had planned to be, the son of a shopkeeper, a silversmith who, as I understand it, had longed to have a son who would be, as my father had become, a scholar, broadly respected at the university. The deportation to the camps of Vienna's Jewish population came slowly at first, but by October 1941 was fully underway. With the assistance of the leaders of the Jewish community under the direction of Rabbi Mermelstein, Jews were sent off to the east in batches of 1,000 in closed freight cars. My father, his wife, and his son were among the first to go. He was pleased to be sent to the concentration camp at Buchenwald, where many noted Viennese had preceded him. The boy, now 7, developed a painful ear infection on the trip. By the time they were herded off the cattle car in Buchenwald, the boy was crying nearly constantly, whimpering and moaning in pain. His mother begged the guards for medical treatment. Finally, after 3 days, a guard agreed, took the child from the barracks by the hand, and immediately outside the door, shot him. Where the boy, my brother Isaac, died. These events, which my father never once mentioned to me during his lifetime, defined him. They were with him every day. They transformed him, forgive me, deformed him, as a tree can be misshapen by tethering it as a sapling. He needed no injunction never to forget. It was from my mother that I learned what transpired in short, unbearable conversations over the years. One of the great agonies of her Alzheimer's was that the horrible recollection of the camps survived with her far longer than anything else except probably her memories of me. During the stage when she could still speak of things with clarity, she repeated a phrase I had heard from her from time to time. "The best did not survive," she said. "Those who would not wheedle or cheat, who shared with the sick. I think they were admired to a degree, but admiration in such circumstances is a very fleeting feeling. Then my mother, frail and enfeebled, her flesh loose, her eyes dull, but her very look still deeply familiar and precious to me, made certain to face me. I have lived the rest of my life recalling them, she said. She cleared her throat. They are my heroes. Death deepens my wonder at her. She was surely wrong, for my heart allows no doubt that she was among the best. But I realize that in her usual, deep, and delicate way, she meant to communicate to me some exculpation of my father. For no matter who they were when they entered those horrible facilities, neither she nor he nor any other human being could be subjected on a prolonged basis to such confinement, such humiliation, such intense and repeated brutality, such incessant privation, fear, and constant debasement, and emerge with their humanity fully intact. I accept this. It seems obvious to me. Although you can travel to corners of this city, to the towers of Grace Street or Fielder's Green, and see the lesson is not yet learned. One of the thousand morals of the story of Abraham and Isaac is that the parents' ordeal, and we all have ours, will inevitably become the child's, as my father and mother's ordeal became mine, and mine, no doubt, became Sarah's and Isaac's. But it is also a tale of survival and of mercy. In the end, Abraham heard his God instruct him not to set his hand against his son. Isaac was spared. He survived and surmounted. He became a parent, blind to Jacob's defects, but one who, pointedly, attempted no sacrifices of his own. I bear my father the intense gratitude I ought to. Lame and halting, he still went on. But surely we could have both done better. Here, at the end, things can be put simply. My father and I often treated each other cruelly. I am sore with shame at the memory of my craziest antics, and would have been more at peace if I had seen in my father any trace of a similar regret. I wish we had negotiated some truce, some settlement. It would have been hard bargaining. No doubt he trumped me in the category of suffering, particularly since much of mine has been self-inflicted, which, generally speaking, people of his age and experience refuse to recognize as pain. But couldn't we have matched up, soul for soul, those two dead little boys, his son and mine? The Isaacs whose fathers could not save them? Isn't there a point of absolute equality in futility and despair? Yet we learn, we grow, we gain. Sarah, surely you and I have already done much better. There's a great deal in that. So, I think about Isaac, my son, my brother, my father's son, the first son of the Western faiths, and I think about the story that is told again and again. We hear it first as children and repeat it throughout our lives. We tell it by way of apology and warning. We tell it with some measure of hope. We tell it because we have all been the child, we have all been Isaac, and we know the part of the story that is never mentioned. For the Bible does not record Isaac's responses. We do not know if he, like Jesus, asked, "Father, why have you forsaken me?" We do not know if he begged the way most of us would for his life. We know only this, that he obeyed, that he was a child, that because he knew nothing else, he did as his father required. We know he allowed himself to be bound in rope. We know he let his father lay him on the altar of pyramided firewood, which together they had raised to God. We know he watched his father on the mountaintop raise the gleaming knife above his breastbone. We know he was a child, the son of a man with a big idea, who in his longing and confusion, even in his final instance, could only look to his father with that eternal, if foundering, hope for love.
Eulogy for Bernhard Weissman by Hobart Tariq Tuttle, April 1st, 1996. Allah, Yahweh, sweet Jesus, by whatever name we know you, Lord, take the soul of Bernhard Weissman. You caused him in his life to confront terrible wickedness. He now deserves your eternal peace. Were we all of us here, to share our memories of Bernhard Weissman, you'd hear a lot of different things. There'd be many voices. There are folks here who can tell you he was a genius in his work. Winners of the Nobel Prize in Economics invited him to their table and treated him as a peer. His granddaughter, our sweet Sarah, would tell you he was a great old guy who responded to her kindness. And you've heard Seth say he was a tough father. And I tell you, I was around to see that, and it is word. I can speak only for myself. I like the dude. I'm here as his friend. Sounding goofy, I know, saying I was friends with a fella twice my age, but we were friends. When I was a little kid, he scared the living hell out of me. I remember him wearing those nasty glasses that looked like they pinched your nose, pince-nez, and talking with that funky Viennese accent. Half the time, to start, I couldn't tell if he was speaking to me or clearing his throat. I wanted no part of this cat. But by high school, I had gotten into him. I can tell you a lot of good things about Mr. Weissman. He was funny. Kind of sneaky funny. He'd catch you. I remember a few years ago I was visiting and we were talking about the things we talked about often. Politics, race, America. And I said how I saw how the government had finally relented and was going to let a group of black and Jewish leaders go together to visit various capitals in the Middle East, hoping to make peace.
There is no question, Hopi, that the government wants them to go, he told me. They would rather, however, that they not come back.
And something else I always appreciated about the man. He liked me. Part of that I always knew was for Seth's sake. Bernhard was doing the best he could, taking to Seth's main man, even if he couldn't always do the same for Seth. But he was into me for me, too. I had no doubt about that. I could make him laugh. And he had no trouble with a Negro kid being smart. He was not born American, and he did not have a trace of our color thing, not even a speck of it, on his soul. I appreciated that, I must say. And I have to allow, on my side, that it was easier for me to accept him than many other white folks, because he had paid the price. I could never say to him, "You don't know what it's like." He knew. He understood how it felt to be stuck in this situation, to be labeled and judged, always and constantly under the weight of something you never really fully chose. You know, I'm like everybody else on the planet. I am deeply struck by the suffering of my own. It's a terrible truth that identity is steeped in the blood of martyrs, a phenomenon you can see clear around the world. People everywhere grouped under ethnic banners, and all of them beefing about the way their kin were treated in times past. The Armenians, the Kurds, the Igbo, the Rome. The list is damn near endless. Everybody recalls their oppressors. Even the pilgrims, WASPs, who I grew up thinking had everything, celebrated Thanksgiving to recollect how bad folks back in England had been to them. And the fact is, nobody's making this stuff up. We cannot bear homage to those who made us without recognizing their suffering. But it's a sad lesson, nonetheless, that we all so often lay claim to our heritage out of fear of those who once hated us, and thus may do so again. But I'm like the rest. I have always known the pain of black folks. All my life, I felt it in my bones. We had it good in my home, no complaint about that, but It didn't take me very long, even as a little kid, to notice how hard it was for so many others, and to see that a whole lot of those folks had the same skin on them as I did. I'm the first to tell you that I did not have a clue what to do with that. As a young man, I didn't want the burden. And then I discovered I'd never know myself, never accept myself, unless I took it up. And the absolutely amazing part, as I look back, is that the person who taught me more about dealing with that, the man in my life, is Bernhard Weissman. I'm sure if there had been some cagey old ex-slave who lived down the block, I'd have sat at his feet instead. But there wasn't. I guess Bernhard was the closest thing I could find, a first-hand victim of unbearable oppression. Someone I could ask what I see now I was always asking him, even though I never once said it out loud. Namely, how do you come to terms? The last time I saw him, I was asking that again. I was truly in a state, upset. I was trying a lawsuit, a very confusing lawsuit. It was confusing to me because I saw what I see every day in a new light. Usually, I view the life of the ghettoized as a professional. I see it case by case. One crime, one rousting, this thieving client, that dishonest cop. I render what aid I can on that basis, one at a time. But being home, I somehow lost my grip on my professional perspective. I saw the larger picture again, and it was, at moments, heartrending. A terrible thing is happening here, in our midst. And I saw how hatred and desperation may yet engulf us all. And I talked to Bernhard about this. We talked. We went out there, not far away, and inched along the midway. That beautiful tree-lined esplanade with its benches on the west side of U Park. It was one of those mysterious late autumn days in the Midwest. The pewter sky losing the hope of light. The big trees stretching black and stark. The walks slick with moldering yellow leaves. Bernhard listened to me as I confided my anguish, and he confronted me with an odd question. "Do you know, Hopi?" he asked. "Where this midway comes from?" I didn't, of course. So he told me the story. During the Civil War, after the Yanks had freed the Mississippi River, they used to freight Confederate prisoners up here, far from the front lines. These Rebs, 20,000 of them, ended up imprisoned here on the land that now stands beneath the midway. The city was pretty much a wreck by then. There were no provisions. Everything was being commandeered for the front. There wasn't food to spare, nor coats, nor blankets. And in the dead of winter, these prisoners, Southern boys, some who'd barely seen a frost, just basically stood out here on the midway and died. Froze to death. More than 12,000 of them. They buried those Confederate soldiers right there. And after Dixie was subdued, the city fathers, embittered by war and eager to forget its horrors, plowed the ground over and planted grass and trees rather than raise gravestones. You think about that, though. Those lovely stone mansions up on Grand Boulevard, they were there by the 1850s. It was a fashionable street. Ladies in their hoop skirts went perambulating up and down every day. They walked their babies. And yonder, behind a mess of wire and fences, stood the Rebs, huddling under the trees for cover in the snow, freezing and screaming and carrying on, crying out for mercy, and dying. Every day, a couple got shot trying to escape. It was something for me to think about, of course, because it called up all of an African-American's complicated feelings about the Civil War. I still cleave to a schoolboy's understanding of those events, because I think it is fundamentally correct. In the minds of many of those fighting, probably most, it was the war to free the slaves. Oh, sure, it had 1,000 other motives, too, Genovese and them all. I read the books. But for the most part, there were Americans who, no matter how they varnished it over with talk of states' rights or the cotton economy, were willing to die for the right to own a nigger. And other Americans, hundreds of thousands of them, white Americans, prepared to lay down their lives because God wanted all his children, including the black ones, to be free. I often think we do well in this country to bear both facts in mind. Surely I had them in mind at that moment, and although a part of me listened to Bernhard's story in shock, to think that I had walked 1,000 times across the unmarked graves of young soldiers who died so pitifully in their own country. Another part of me, the greater part, I confess, heard this with the parched thirst of a people who have never had a full measure of revenge. For it occurred to me at once that those men, cruelly imprisoned, were slaveholders and their supporters. And I thought to myself, good. This was good, and was as it had to be. Well, there was a look we shared then, Bernhard and me, he the survivor of a similar captivity, and I the great-grandson of slaves. He read the thought passing behind my eyes as surely as if I had spoken it, and I do not believe we exchanged another word as we walked slowly home. Bernhard made his mistakes, but we cannot lay him to rest without admiring his strength of character. He had the courage to tell me what he meant to out on the Midway, which was that this would never end. He could hardly be faulted for that view, not only because of his own experience, but given what has gone on since, dozens of hideous episodes that seem to show that humankind has not learned a damn thing from all that suffering. Pol Pot's killing fields, Idi Amin, the Chinese slaughters in Tibet, the Ayatollah's annihilation of the Baha'i, the Hutus' dismemberment of the Tutsis, the disappeared in Argentina, the carnage in Bangladesh, in Biafra, in Bosnia. We may only pray it does not happen here. We cannot blame Bernhard for his pessimism. There are days, many, many days, when I know in my bones he was right. But perhaps there is another way to accept his legacy. Perhaps there is meaning in these millions of seemingly meaningless deaths. Perhaps Darwin, or God, is sending the species signs so large we cannot fail to heed them. Perhaps our survival depends on recognizing that we can be monsters, so that self-awareness reinforces our commitment to what is more noble in us. For in his lifetime, Bernhard also saw freedom in South Africa, the enfranchisement of women in the West, the withering of colonialism, the blooming of democracy in nation after nation, and the growth of a million varieties of the fruit of human cunning, which have immeasurably advanced knowledge and well-being across the planet. Perhaps that was what Bernhard meant to tell me, after all. We are both. We are the tyrant and the democrat, the captor and the survivor, the slaveholder and the slave. We are blood heirs to each heritage. On the best days, his and mine, that is what I hope Bernhard would admonish all of us. Never to forget.
September 7th, 1996. Sunny. Sunny is sick. As she envisions it, the cancer is a fire, an errant spark that smolders and is never out, an ember no larger than an atom that somehow licks itself to life and burns through her flesh with ghoulish smells and unbearable heat she somehow does not feel. It grows. The cancer burns. In the dream, the light of fire magnifies itself until her breast is glowing like E.T.'s heart in the movie Nikki is always watching, until the blaze shows the palpitating strength of life, so that life resembles death, and the fire suddenly blooms in a monstrous explosion of light, the dreaded atomic flashpoint of her childhood, ending all the world. No, she screams into the dark. And Seth, struggling awake, claps his hand over her mouth, then holds her from behind. For a long moment, their bodies move together in the labored breath of terror. She has warned him. The dreams come every 6 months or so, and the fear is plundering. It hangs in her bones like the ache of an ailment until she has a mammogram. she will call Gwen in the morning. With luck, they can take her today. Embracing her, Seth kisses her neck, then her mouth, stale with sleep. Oh, I hate this, I hate this, Sunny declares in the dark. And even when Gwendolyn's called and told me everything's all right, I'll still worry. Because what do I do the day it isn't all right? That won't happen. Don't treat me like a child, Seth. You can't make promises. Sunny, look, we go on, okay? You don't know, and I don't know, but we go on. It hasn't happened, and I trust it won't. It's Nikki, she says. It's deserting her, failing her that way. That's the worst part. It's torture to think that for everything I've done and tried to do, that she'll be alone. Nikki will be okay. That I can promise you. Sunny sits up, damp with sweat. She has started to grow cold. She grabs the satin binding of the blanket which her thrashing wrested from the mattress and draws it around herself. To leave her with Charlie, God, says Sunny. Over my dead fucking body will she be with Charlie? Forget that. He's her father. When was the last time he called? A cottonwood has more feeling for its lint than Charlie has for his children. She actually laughs. It's terrible. Does Seth delight her any more than at the moments he speaks of Charlie, riled by contempt and wrath? If I tell Charlie I'm taking care of her, that I'm adopting her, he'll be relieved. You know that. Adopt her. Seth could do that. The law. Oh, thank God for the law. Charlie can consent and Seth can adopt her. Would you really adopt her? Today. Do you mean it? She feels him move from her and is blinded then by the bedside light. When she removes her hand, Seth is staring at her. Look into my eyes, he intones. I mean it. If you'll have it, if she'll have it, we'll start whenever. She's precious to me. You know that. She thinks out loud, what if Charlie won't go along? You tell Charlie he doesn't have to pay child support anymore, says Seth, and he'll crawl here from Cincinnati to sign. In the absolute quiet of night, Sunny laughs, a pure bubble of delight. He's right. You really mean it? Of course I mean it. Seth can adopt her. I want to know you understand how important this is to me, Sunny says. Right now, I'm here, and whatever happens between us happens. But if I'm gone, promise, she says. Promise me you really understand and really mean this. You're going to be fine. I need your promise. I don't want to think of her in someone's home and not being a part of it. I don't want her feeling she's in between like I did whenever I was with my aunt and uncle. That I didn't really have a place there, that I was sweet and nice, but not fully tied to them. I don't want that. Bring her into your life, completely. Will you promise? Promise that. Fine, he says. Okay. Don't humor me, Seth. This is the most serious thing in my life. Sunny, I'm as serious as you are. Because if you promise this and don't do it, I will haunt you. I will be a mean ghost. I really will. You have to take her in. Let her feel she belongs to you, as she belongs to me. I want you to promise you'll be her father, not a stranger. Not just somebody who thinks she's wonderful, but someone committed to her life as his legacy. Someone who wants her to understand everything that is deepest in you. That's what you have to promise. Give her what you know most purely is yourself. I'm serious. Of course, I promise that. I know what it means to be somebody's father, Sonny. Right now, here today, she's my daughter. I want to know you mean it. Forlornly, he looks into the brightness of the bedside lamp for quite some time. What would you say? His face in the harsh light swims in feeling. He starts again. If it's all right with both of you. He gets no further. Say it, Seth. I need to hear this. When he turns, his look contains all his familiar skepticism about himself. "I think I'd like to raise her as a Jew," he says.
This has been an Hachette audio production of The Laws of Our Fathers. Written by Scott Turow. Read by James Snyder, Orla Cassidy, Dion Graham, and Kevin T. Collins. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Rick Harris. Recorded by Richard Romaniello. Post-production by Richard Romaniello for R&R Productions. The Laws of Our Fathers is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1996 by Scott Turow. Audio production copyright and published 2010 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.